This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is known as the RZA. He's the chief composer and producer of the Wu-Tang Clan, which the All Music Guide calls the most revolutionary rap group of the mid-90s. They turned the concept of a hip-hop crew inside out. Wu-Tang was a loose congregation of 9 MCs. Each of them worked under several different pseudonyms and spun off side projects. Time magazine called the group a branded marketing juggernaut. The RZA is also known as Prince Rakim, Bobby Digital, the Resurrector, and Robert Diggs, which is his birth name. He joined his cousins GZA, the Genius, and Old Dirty Bastard in 1992 to form the Wu-Tang Clan. The name was taken from a mythical martial arts sword style, said to be exceptionally difficult to master but unbeatable in battle. The RZA has also composed music for several films, including Jim Jarmusch's Ghost Dog, and Kill Bill and its sequel, directed by Quentin Tarantino, who shares the RZA's passion for martial arts movies. Now the RZA has a new book called The Wu-Tang Manual. Here's Cream from the Wu-Tang Clan's 1993 debut album.
I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job, had second hands. Moms bounced on old men, so then we moved to Shaolin Land. A young youth, you're rocking the go-to. In the New York was drug loot. And let's start it like this, son. Rolling with this one and that one, pulling out gas for fun. But it was just a dream for the team who was a fiend. Started smoking rules at 16 and running up in gates and doing hits by high stakes, making my way off fire skates. No question I was speed for cracks and weed. The combination made my eyes bleed. No question I would flow off and try to get the door.
That's the Wu-Tang Clan. My guest is the RZA. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, y'all.
Now, you know, in addition to being, you know, an MC and to being one of the rappers with Wu-Tang Clan, you were also the chief producer and arranger. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, composing and sampling the music backing for the records? What your approach is to that?
Well, my musical knowledge really came from being a DJ. You know, at the age of 11, I got my first pair of turntables, straight arm techniques, you know what I mean? The hardest ones that you could scratch on. And I was in, building up an extensive record collection. Even as a DJ with a four track, my production style was similar to the style you hear on 36 Chambers, which was taking something from old soul music to something from a funky drum, you know, whether James Brown or Willie Mitchell type drum pattern, and then come with maybe a Woody Woodpecker record, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then mix that in with some kind of classical. So I was a kind of DJ that would do that. When I would DJ at parties, you know, when I would interlude between records, I may throw on a Peter Pan quote or something, and then throw on a crazy hip-hop gutter beat that makes the crowd go crazy. So when I start producing, I had that same approach.
So were you, you know, since you had such a wide variety of musical records that you were drawing from, were any of those records things that you first heard from your parents' record collections?
Oh, guaranteed. I mean, you know, everything started from what our parents had, of course.
So what was in your parents' collection?
Oh, my parents had all the soul records from, you know, from, I had a single mother most of the time, but from the Crusaders to the OJs to the Delphonics to the Temptations, you know what I mean? All the way to Kenny Rogers was in the crate, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So my mother was, being a single mother, I guess she probably went through a lot of different feelings and changes. And she had a lot of different artists and records that she would play, you know, over the years. But what made my selection and collection so ill was it wasn't only my parents' records. I was taking everybody's parents' records, you know what I mean? I went to Inspector Deckhouse, and his mother had a whole closet full of old records that she gave me. Ghostface Moms, I mean, people that be in New York City in the village just selling records on the street corner. I mean, I'm the kind of kid that buys everything. I used to buy records everywhere, anywhere, no matter what. And I'm still kind of like that, you know. I've collected records from over probably 40 different countries.
Let's talk a little bit about how you started composing, because you know you first were DJing, basically you were sampling things from records and playing records under raps, but you actually compose now. So how did you make that transition?
That was pretty something that came to being, I think, around 1995, 96. You know, I had a few platinum records under my belt already. I was getting worldwide recognition and really a lot of praises from the music industry and community about what I did, what I've done, the sound that I was bringing to the table. But I took a look and was like, you know what? Wow. I'm considered a famous musician, but technically, as far as terminology, I'm not a musician because there's no instrument that I could really say I could play. And so I kind of felt like I'm one of the kind of people that like to be part of a fraternity because he earned it. And so I took the time out to start reading books on the music theory and studying chord progressions and the way things should be. Because I always heard it, you know what I mean? Always heard it, you know, by listening to songs or if you listen to some of my samples. When hip-hop was only doing one-loop samples or maybe two-bar samples, I came with the four bars or I came with you know, sample changes, you know, as if I played it, you know what I mean? I was able to take, you know, three different parts from one song and make it become, you know, an intro, a verse, and a chorus. So I had the song structure and arrangement always in my mind, but I had to use other people's music. But around 1996, I decided to start studying the theory and being able to make my own progressions and make my own phrases of music. And that's what started leading into me being a composer. You know, I always sampled stuff that was similar to that anyway, and so I wanted to learn how to play it myself, how to express it myself. And I think in 1997 on the Wu-Tang Forever album, you first hear me doing things like that. You listen to songs like Triumph, and you hear how the strings, you know, they come in. They have, you know, it's played staccato, but it's a rise to it. So it's like dun 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 dun. It rises up and then they drop out, and then the voice will come in, and then that'll drop out. Then you just hit a guitar hit with the piano. So that was like doing 97 is when I started experimenting with the theory of music, chord progressions, and things like that, mixed with my sample DJ background. And that's how I produced Wu-Tang Forever.
Well, let's hear Triumph from Wu-Tang Forever. Here it is.
I bomb atomically. Socrates, philosophies, and hypotheses. Can't define how I be dropping these mockeries. Lyrically perform armed robbery. Flee with the lottery. Possibly they spotted me. Battle scarred, showgun. Explosion when my pen hits. Tremendous. Ultraviolet, shine, blind forensics. I inspect, view through the future, see millennium. Killer bees sold 50 gold, 60 platinum. Shackling the matches with drastic rap tactics. Graphic displays melt the steel like blacksmiths. Black Wu jackets, queen bees ease the guns in. Rumbling with patrolmen, tear gas, lace the function. Heads by the score, take flight inside a war. Ticks hit the floor, die hard fans demand more. Behold the bold soldier, control the glow slowly. Proceeds the blow, swinging swords like shinobi. Stomp grounds and bam, footprints of solid rock. Who got it locked, performing live on your hottest fly.
As the world turns, I spread like germ. Bless the globe with the pestilence. The hard-headed never learn. This my testament to those burned. Play my position in the game of life, standing firm. On foreign land, jump the gun out the frying pan. Into the fire, transform into the Ghost Rider. A six-pack and a streetcar named Desire.
That's Triumph from the album Wu-Tang Forever. And my guest is the RZA of the Wu-Tang Clan, also a solo artist. And now he has a new book called The Wu-Tang Manual. You know, you do something on some of your music that I think you call a detuned piano. And listening to it, I never knew whether it was an electric piano or what, but it has this really distinctive sound. And in fact, I want to play something from the Jim Jarmusch movie, Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. And you did the score for this movie, and it's really...
Yeah, that's my first score.
Yeah, and it's really wonderful. Let me play the theme from it. That's music from the Jim Jarmusch movie, Ghost Dog, The Way
Ghost
of
Dog.
The Samurai, composed by my guest, the RZA. What are you doing on that? What's the keyboard that we're hearing?
The keyboard that I use for Ghost Dog, I use a combination, but I use mostly, it's a keyboard called the Kurzweil 2500, and there's another keyboard called the Insonic ASR-10. And the ASR-10 is a sampling keyboard. The Kurzweil is also a sampling keyboard, but it's made with this thing they call VAS technology, which is Variable Architect Synthesis Technology. And that means that this particular keyboard can emulate any other keyboard ever created. If you just use the filters and play with the filters,
mm-hmm.
it can emulate any other keyboard and potentially any instrument if you know the proper parameters. And the Ghost Dog theme, the doo-doo, it sounds like it was a partial of a flute sample just taken out, just one frequency of it, and then played across the piano. So that was how I came up with that right there, mixed in with some muddy string pads, you know what I mean, and a muddy string guitar sample. Da-na-na-na. So it was a pretty awkward combination, but the sound of it, is funny. When I made that particular song, the sound of it was to go along with Ghost Dog had a lot of birds in this movie, you know. And reading, studying music, I read about Peter and the Wolf and how the composer used an instrument to reflect each animal. For instance, when the wolf came, he threw on the trombones. When the bird came, he threw on the flute. So this is why on the Ghost Dog theme, you hear that flute in there, because he had a lot of birds. And when the movie first came on, the bird was flying. So I started with that flute sound so you could feel that joyfulness. But it's also put into a RZA context. It was joy mixed with sorrow and morbid.
Morbidity, did you say? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, there's something very eerie about the theme.
That's what I mean. I think I meant eerie. Then, if morbid and eerie don't mean the same thing. Do they mean the same thing? Morbid
no.
and eerie?
Well, eerie is kind of mysterious, and morbid has to do with death, but I think it's both, because the movie has a lot to do with death.
Right. Well, I'll say eerie then, and morbid, because I wanted to be like to capture the spirituality of the bird, but also to capture like the internal of Ghost Dog. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
He's yeah.
a very troubled individual, really.
So you use the word detuned. What do you mean by detuned, and what is detuned in the music industry?
When the piano gets old, right, and it sits in your studio for a long time, it becomes detuned. Meaning, you know, all the notes are maybe not a half step, but maybe a 1/8 of a step, just out of tune mm-hmm. in the proper chromatic order. And I like that sound. You know, most people come in and go, I need to tune the keyboard, or I need to tune the piano, or tune the guitar. I like it when it's detuned, because that means it's not in the musical harmony according to the theory of music, but yet it has a harmony of its own. And that's something that I use a lot throughout whether I sampled the sound or whether I played it. That's the sound I use a lot.
And I think one of the reasons why that works when you do it is because you're often using like one note lines. So
exactly.
There aren't like chords that you're playing, because the chords might sound really raggy, but that single note line it works really well.
Out. Yeah. Yeah, because it's like a person that sings that doesn't really that's vocal trained. He'll be able to sing and give you all the feelings he want to give you, but he may not be able to sing in the key of A, you know. But he'll be able to sing a song that's in the key of A, and just because of his if he has a natural style and a good flow, it just somehow meshes all together. I think that's what hip hop singing is. You know, like a lot of hip hop artists that sing.
Right.
You hear some of these songs. I know, like people hear it on the radio. Like, how is this song on the radio? Or even one of the great hip hop R&B singers, Mary J. Blige, in her early career, a lot of trained musicians was like, "Oh, Mary is always out of tune." But the hip hop generation loved it because there was no sound like that. His only sound was that was her. You know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is hip-hop artist The RZA. He has a new book called The Wu-Tang Manual. Now, you've had several personas over the years. I mean, your birth name is Robert Diggs. You're known as The RZA. That's a name you took when you co-founded the Wu-Tang Clan. Mm-hmm. You're also Bobby Digital. And early in your career, you were Prince Rakim. So let's take it chronologically. let's start with Prince Rakim. I mean, what did you see that persona as being? The music that you made with him is different from Wu-Tang.
I would say so. Well, Prince Rakim, you know what I mean? I was basically more of a student and the studies of life, shall I say, and as well as definitely a student to music and the music industry and things like that. But as Prince Rakim, you know, being young, 17, 18 years old, you know, all you think about is girls, yo. You know what I mean? And I was, you know, pretty popular guy with the girls. Like, you know, a lot of girls found, you know, had good things to say about me. Oh, he's cute, and he always got on some polo and Gucci, and he's just, you know. And I actually like to carry myself like a prince. I was the kind of kid that, you know, kept his fingernails right. You know what I mean? Wouldn't touch my food without a napkin, and, you know, walked like Mr. Spock, had my hands behind my back. I used to walk very straight up and very elegant, you know what I mean? That's how I felt, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And I probably had about 30 different polo suits that I got, you know, because we had many ways to make hustles back then. But every day I'll come out with a new suit on. You may see me wear a powder blue polo suit with a gold chain, you know, gold teeth. And just something real fly, you know what I mean? And that was kind of the persona of Prince Rakim. He was definitely a fly guy, as the word was back in those days.
Why don't we hear a 1991 record that you made as Prince Rakim, and this is "Ooh, I Love You, Rakim."
Oh no, okay, let's go for it. Come on.
Okay.
It seems I'm a fiend for a sex routine. Love to hit 'em scream.
Ooh, Rakim.
And my response is oh, always satisfied 'em. You know how I flow. With sex, I'm not lazy. I'm buck wild and crazy. I kiss the bosoms, but never eat the daisies. And my ladies love me deeply because I'm handsome, charming, and freaky. And when they meet me, they won't go. And now I'm stuck.
Okay, so let's move from Prince Rakim to the RZA. How does the RZA compare to Prince Rakim?
Well, when I came with Wu-Tang Clan, and the first single was called "Protect Your Neck," and you'll notice in the video, it's like exit Prince Rakim and enter the RZA, because there was no time for me to be a pretty boy. It was no time for me to be this elegant guy that was, you know, into the ladies and into how I dressed and into how I looked. I became the RZA basically, which was a total rebel, really. You know what I mean? You know, somebody that had it with society, and that was coming to get his fair take of society. You notice when I came in as the RZA, I was, you know, came very militant in my look. I was very militant in my action. I just went through so much different personal traumas, as far as with the law, with my life, with people in the streets, the hood, and I basically made a Z. You know what I mean? I made the first curve in my Z, shall I say, And I was like, you know, I'm not longer Prince Rakim. That's part of my attribute, but I'm going to be the RZA. You know what I mean? Because, you know, that means I was strictly dealing with focusedness. It's funny because I didn't even like care how I dressed. I didn't even change my clothes that often. You know what I mean? I just was this one focused individual that was built on making a legacy for himself. And the Z in mathematics, you know what I mean? Because, you know, I study mathematics. And the Z stands for zigzag zig, which represents knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. It means, like, you can go this way, and sometimes you're going to have to zag back because you're going to go back and check on yourself. But then you realize you was going the right way in the beginning, so you zig again. And that shows you that sometimes you may know something, and you can understand it, but if you don't live through it, you know, it's not fully understood by you. And so that zag is me living it out. And when I zagged, you know, I went through so much troubles of life and life experiences. So now I have the experience. So now I have to zig again. And that's what really put that Z in my name. I was like, you know what? I don't went this way, that way. And now I understand which way I got to walk. And I actually walked a very straight, narrow line from the day that I took that title to RZA. I didn't really, commit sins or just, I was a real straightforward, focused, determined individual. And I gave myself a 5-year period, you know what I mean, of to make sure I stayed on that path. And that's what I did.
And after the 5 years?
Well, after the 5 years, which I basically had took that name in 1992. And then by 1997, my idea was I would be on the top that musically, you know, and what I stood for would be the top of the top in the world. You know? And I think in 1997 it happened. I think in 1997 Wu-Tang made a number one record or something like that. It was the number one hip-hop group. number one selling hip-hop group at the time, you know, nominated for Grammys and all that, you know, and really the number one influential groups at that time. So it actually kind of came to fruition from that five-year plan.
So we're talking about your different, you know, personas as a performer. So we've talked about Prince Rakim, the RZA. There's also Bobby Digital.
Right.
Who's Bobby Digital? And,
well, Bobby Digital is actually, it's like a going backwards type of thing because once I took on the persona of the RZA and I took on the responsibility of the RZA, which was basically like a father figure or what the Wu-Tang Clan would call the abbot of all these great minds. And not only abbot of Wu-Tang Clan, but abbot to the Wu-Tang fans, abbot to the students of Wu-Tang, abbot to the people who took the words we said and the inspiration we said and went and got tattoos on their arms and went and really felt this spirit of unity that we brought, you know what I mean? It was kind of strange for Wu-Tang when, you know, you went to Wu-Tang concerts, you're seeing every ethnic group in there together, unified. And so I became the abbot of that situation, the abbot of that movement. But being the abbot, you know, my responsibilities really gave me no time to be this cool New York kid that I was, you know what I mean? This cool street kid, this cool savvy kid that was into the Polo and the Gucci and into that really the Prince Rakim mentality. And so Bobby Digital was basically like a regression back towards that. And the reason why I chose the name Bobby Digital because I didn't want to go back to being Prince Rakim. I wanted to go back maybe a few years before that when, you know, Robert Diggs, you know, my teachers called me Bobby. My last name was Diggs, but we was in a digital world at that time. In my opinion, everything was going digital. I felt that we had to go digital mentally, meaning everything should be on a mathematical code. And we got to keep our minds digital, you know what I mean, in order to keep up with time and space. And so I turned the Diggs into digital, and Bobby Digital was born. But the thing about him was that it was an alter ego that was, you know, also based on my, you know, teenage years, but also based in comic book mythology and based on fantasy, you know what I mean, and based on being an outlet to express some of the things I missed. I mean, as Bobby Digital, that's when I first started partying again. I remember spending maybe $100,000 a month just having good times because I didn't have good times during the main Wu-Tang success from the years of 93 to 97. I basically stayed in the basement a lot, you know, kept producing everybody's solo albums, didn't really come outside and didn't really have a lot of girlfriends at that time. I kind of, you know, went from Prince Rakim to being the RZA, which was the abbot or some kind of hermit, you know, just stayed with one woman and... Which was really the best way to be is with one woman and focus, you know what I mean? But, you know, you definitely miss a lot of fun from the, you know, being an artist. And so it's like when Bobby Digital came, he gave me a chance to kind of take a dip in the pool of sin or in the pool of, I won't say sin, but definitely in the pool of fun and the basic thing that a hip-hop artist or a rock and roll artist would enjoy. And I probably enjoyed that for about two to three years. I enjoyed it heavily until I started coming back out of it, you know what I mean, around the year 2000.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is a great track. This is B-O-B-B-Y from the album RZA as Bobby Digital.
Digital. Yo, you know us to be robust, the greatest crew since Cold Crust. This poisonous slang keep MCs avoiding us. Can't figure out the probabilities for destroying us. Your best bet, black, is sit back and start enjoying us. And run your commissary, attack your pulmonary. I'm a very revolutionary. Honorary, sonic, electronic, brain like Johnny Mnemonic. Get boosted from the sorrow and wood root tonic. You be fickle, get the tongue thrown into a jar of pickles and serve to your bird. But these are pumping nickels. You stay Charlie, your plastic like Marley Marl. Tie your ass down and run you over with a trolley car. When nigga lucky, keep him bucky like dent. Intent, beat the fine print. It says do not enter across the line. You be tossed behind and forced to submit to the rhyme. B-O-B-B-Y.
That's from the album RZA as Bobby Digital. My guest is hip-hop artist The RZA, and he has a new book, which is called The Wu-Tang Manual. I really like that track a lot. You know, it's funny, like your influences, You have so many influences musically, but conceptually too. You know, like one of the really big influences in your life is martial arts movies and right. samurai stories. And, you know, the samurai, man, that's all about focus. That's all about discipline and using all your energy to focus on whatever that skill is. But, you know, your influence is also comic books, and you started off doing more of, like, party records. And, like, the party vibe and the focus vibe are really just coming at it from opposite ends, which right. is one of the reasons why I find it interesting you've had all these different personas, because that's, I guess that's given you the chance to express those different influences.
Yeah, you know... also, I'm I read a lot of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of felt like, even at a young age, and even you know, as I kept going, went through the phases of hip hop, that a name is like an attribute. You know, you read in the Holy Quran, it says, you know, the 99 attributes of God. You know what I mean? And it's different attributes that's used to describe them. And to me, that's how names are. You know what I mean? It's like if you look at me as Prince Rakim, you know, you could kind of picture the kind of person that we're talking about. And even though it's the same person, but it's a characteristics of that person, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And everything has a yin and a yang in it. Everything has a yin and a yang, so it's two extremes. So it could be one extreme of positivity and one extreme of negativity, because that's the yin and the yang of it. And I think being aware that I knew that personalities sometimes can't have names. And not schizophrenically, but definitely a personality can be named. And you notice that a lot of artists in hip hop, as well as artists in the music industry. Look at Garth Brooks; he even came with a alter ego to describe a certain sound of music he was doing that wasn't in line with what his fans knew, but it was something that he felt, and he named it something different. You know what I mean?
What would you say has been the influence of martial arts movies on you as a performer or as an artist?
Oh man, I think martial art movies have given me a tremendous amount of influence and inspiration. I mean, not only from the beautiful fight scenes and the beautiful art they display, but even the storylines and the heroic way that the martial art films pit their characters. You know, you'll see one man fighting 10 men, you know what I mean? Or you'll see three men up against an army, and each one will die for each other no matter what. Like, I got it, brother, you leave. No, brother, you leave. You see that kind of loyalty in the film. That inspired me. And also the music and the stings and the stabs that used to come out of nowhere because a fight scene has to be edited, and so therefore the music had to be edited to match the fight scenes. And they had a very abstract flow of music in these movies. So I had a lot of inspiration on that. And then finally, the philosophy, you know. I was able to pick up on the philosophy that was being talked about in some of these movies early, because I was familiar with certain kind of knowledge and from reading the Bible and things like that. So there's a movie called The 36 Chambers where you see the monks are talking to each other. And one monk is like, he's saying the five tones deafen every ear. You know what I mean? The five colors blind every eye, you know. Silence is bliss. Do you hear the sound of bells? We hear nothing. All is empty. And so you're just looking at these people say this, you're like, what is this right here? you know what I mean? Without wisdom, mm-hmm. there is no gain. And this is a kung fu movie. And that was like the 35th chamber of kung fu, which was basically studying sutras, memorizing them, and talking about them. And I was inspired by that, yo. I started like paying attention to what they were saying in these movies, and I kind of caught like a fantasy history of the Shaolin Temple, their heroes, what happened to it, how it got burnt down, and I learned all this from movies. And when I went back and referred this information I got from movies to the real historical facts, maybe some of the names were not right, but the incidents were correct.
What were the movie theaters that you went to when you were a kid to see the martial art films?
Oh, 42nd Street was flooded with kung fu movies during maybe from the year of 1979 to the year of 1984. I mean, you could go on 42nd Street, and if it was maybe a dozen theaters on that one strip, showing, you know, with two or three screens inside these theaters, you could bet that there was at least 15 martial art films on the strip at any given moment. And I'm a kind of kid that would go to the movies and watch three martial art films at one screen, come back the next day, go across the street and watch the three that they had, you know what I mean? And so I was a fiend, and 42nd Street was like the capital of that.
How old were you? You were living in one of the boroughs, either Brooklyn or...
Yeah, Brooklyn and Staten Island, back and forth.
So how old were you when you could go by yourself or with friends on the subway to get to Manhattan?
Well, I'm a street kid. I was riding the subways by myself by the age of 9. That's just because New York is like that, you know what I mean? Growing up with a single parent and a house full of brothers and sisters, I come from a family of 11 brothers and sisters. So you could imagine the kind of independency that fell on some of us as children, you know what I mean? And so I was riding trains to Manhattan at the age of 9. By the time I was 11 years old, I was taking myself and my little 7-year-old brother with me and my 6-year-old brother all the way from Brownsville, Brooklyn, to 42nd Street, Manhattan. That's like a 45-minute train ride. And we'll get off and go to the movies. And the movies actually have signs on it, 17 and older only. And I'll have to ask a stranger on the street to buy my tickets and all that just to get inside the theater and sit there and watch some kung fu films. Bringing food from home, maybe some chicken wings in my pocket or something, you know what I mean? It was crazy, but it was a path that when I look back on it, I look at it as a destined path, because the urge and the hunger that attracted me to martial arts and the urge and the hunger that would attract me to travel all the way from Staten Island to get on a bus to a ferry to a train and ride all the way past Yankee Stadium, you know, to go hear hip-hop, to go to Soundview Projects with the Jizza, to hear somebody rapping and talking and to see breakdancing, or to travel all over and ride trains just to write your name and graffiti on it. You know, it's strange how the urges of it is like almost as strong as the urge of sex. You know what I mean? When, you know, a sex urge leads men to all kind of foul malpractices, from rape to suicide if a man get his heart broke like that. So imagine that same kind of drive and urge for martial arts and for the study of knowledge and for music and hip-hop. It's like, that's the kind of urges I had, and it was kind of a blind urge too, because I really didn't understand it until now. I see that, wow, what a path that was chosen for me.
Okay, so you just had this instinctive urge to hear music, to go wherever you had to hear the music you wanted to hear, and to go as far as you needed to see the movies you wanted to see, and that was an incredible education for you, particularly in the field that you are in, which is music,
yeah, exactly,
and movies, because you write scores for movies. What was actual school like for you, where you were officially supposed to be getting your education?
Well, in school, I made a lot of teachers that was very impressed with me, but I wasn't a very attendant student, you know what I mean? I mean, any given year, whether it was even living with my mother from poverty and from the times we suffered, you know, with so many brothers and sisters, and it's like, I mean, I would miss 40 days out of any given school year. And when I became a high school student, I basically, you know, the first year, I kind of tried to stay focused. And it was hard. I mean, it was times when I didn't have a nickel to catch the bus to go to school. And the school was maybe like a 45-minute to an hour walk. And, you know, going through all that, the first year, I struggled and struggled. And I made the honor roll, and they offered me a scholarship to write. And, you know, I was on the school newspaper and all them things. But by the time my sophomore year, I was a hooky playing, 40-ounce drinking, girl chasing, give up on school, trying to find a way to make a dollar, trying to find a way to hustle. But what saved me, I think, in the long run was whether I went to school or not, I would always study. So I may wake up at 9 o'clock in the morning and go, I'm not going to school. But still sit there for 2 hours and read and study first before I go outside.
What would you read and study?
Well, I'm a type of, I would study the books I got from school, whether it was my math book, my science book. I would study any book I got from school. At this time, I was, I loved the Bible, so I would read the Bible a lot. And also, we had what was called the 120 lessons, that's taught from the Nation of Gods and Earths, that's dealing with questions of actually a lot of controversial questions about history and about science and certain things. Like, there's one question: what makes rain, hail, snow, and earthquakes? And the answer to the question was: the earth is covered under water 3/4 of its surface, and the sun and moon have attracting powers on our planet towards water up into the earth rotation, which is called gravitation, and the fine mist that your eye can't see. But as this mist ascends higher and increases with other mists of water and different currents of the atmosphere until it becomes heavier than gravitation, then it distills back to the earth in the form of drops of water or drops of ice, which depends on how heavy the mist was or the current of the air was in. So, you know, we had to memorize these things like that. So I would memorize that kind of information. You know, the total square miles of the planet Earth, 196,940,000 square miles. How much is land? 57,285,000 square miles of land. How much is water? 139,685,000 square miles of water. We would be, you know, we would quiz each other on these things. And at the same time, I'm learning about magnetism, the properties of light, and chemistry. But I just didn't have the patience to sit in the class or the attention power to sit in the class and listen to a teacher tell me these things, because I would be thinking of a girl or something, or thinking, you know, even sometimes, you know, it's funny, and I say this out loud because I know a lot of men can relate. Sometimes you could be a 14-year-old boy in the classroom, and all you're thinking about is having sex with the teacher. You know what I mean? And it's crazy. You'll be sitting there just looking and looking, no matter what she's trying to teach you, say to you, all you is dreaming about is, man, what if you could just take Mrs. Boer in the back? You know what I mean? And I realized that in my own self, that this is a this is a real true distraction of life, and I should take time to stay at home and read and study myself. And that's why, you know, self-knowledge is important and self-study is important, no matter, because whether you go to school, whether you go to a kung fu class, for instance, you're not going to learn the technique because of math, because you're going to the class. No, it's going to be your self-practice, your self-dedication on the side that's going to help you perfect what you need to perfect.
You were writing rhymes. You started writing rhymes when you were about 9, I think.
Yeah, I wrote my first lyric. I stole them from the age of 8 to 9, but at 9, I wrote my first lyric. Yeah.
So, do you remember what your first lyric was?
I kind of remember. It was something like, you see the girl with the biggest breasts. You know what I mean? Oh, I would like to get my hands under her dress. It was definitely straight up, you know, the wrong thing to think about. But, you know, it was sex fantasy.
Even when you were 9?
Oh, man. You could imagine growing up in the hood. I mean, 9 years old, you tried things at 9 years old, yo. I mean, I want to get to into my personal life and get psychological, but I mean, I tried at the age of 9, and I know at the age of 11 I was successful at doing what I wanted to do. You know what I mean? By the time I got to 11, I knew many things about women already. Huh. So that's just. I don't know if that's, I think that's just growing up poor. Somebody told me that. I was talking to Quentin Tarantino. We had a long talk about this, right? And he said, I was talking about how my children don't seem to be like me. Like, you know, at the age of 9, I already had marijuana in my system, drinking 40 ounces. It was only quarts back then, drinking 32 ounces of Old English. And I was only 9 years old, smoking joints and stuff like that. So it's like, I look at my son. I have a 9-year-old son right now. He don't know nothing. About nothing. And it seemed like his life is totally oblivious to where I was at that age. And I was talking to Quentin about that, like, you know, trying to, like, ponder and understand. He basically kind of gave me some insight. He said that when you were poor, you know what I'm saying, you don't get a chance to truly live your childhood out. There's so many things on your mind, so many things that's pulling you. And sex is probably one of the best, cures or regression, you know, sex and drugs from the problems of the world. So he pointed that out to me, and I was like, you might be right, because now that my children, you know, they have everything they want, and, you know, they basically the children of a millionaire. And so they play with Godzilla all day. They playing with toys right now, when by the time we was 9 or 10, when I grew up, a gun, you seen a gun in your hand already, you know?
Well, you were really lucky, you know, like having that kind of childhood and emerging,
surviving,
yeah, emerging so intact, not to mention successful. And, you know, one of your cousins, ODB, who was also in Wu-Tang Clan, I mean, he died, I think, of a heart attack or some kind of heart problem. But, you know, he wasn't so lucky in the sense that he was in and out of jail for a while, in and out of prison.
I know. I think the time when I said that changed, the time when it was time for me to really walk a positive straight line and to put my trust and put my trust in God would probably be the terminology that people will understand. Put my trust in God and try to reflect His image, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
On earth, like be God instead of being a man or being a devil. No, show God qualities. When I made that decision to do that, I think I made it at the right time because I think I was headed to death also. I mean, you know, I was in violent things with people. I was doing all kind of things that was definitely, not a good citizen. You know, I don't like to see nobody doing these things these days, you know what I mean? But I know how it is to struggle, but at the same time, it's like, it got to be a better way. But at the 1992, I never forget, you know, I had won a trial, and I got the chance to say, you know what? I'm not doing negativity no more.
What was the trial for?
Or the trial, I think attempted murder trial, you know what I mean? I won as self-defense, you know what I mean? And I ain't turning back, yo.
Did you think at that point you might have been convicted and ended up behind bars for a long time?
I was gone, yo. I couldn't believe I won. You know what I mean? Because the person, you know, of course, you bring injury to somebody. You know, they're not going to want to be your friend. But the person really had it out for me, and he really wanted me to go to jail. I mean, he had it out for me so much that he wound up telling lies and things of that. And that's what helped me out, is that he had too much of a personal vendetta that he had fabricated the story. And you know, all you need is a one reasonable doubt to win a trial. And that's what saved me, that this guy just started lying about certain things that he didn't have to lie about, but he wanted me down so bad. And when I won the trial, I realized that, you know, what I did, I won't say whether it was right or wrong, because it was, you know, some guys, and it was, you know, out of order coming on me like that. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't the guy to do that to. I was, you know, I didn't bother nobody, but if you don't mess with me, trust me, you don't want to mess with me. Messing with me is not the right thing to do, you know what I mean? And they made that decision, and the results was gunfire. That was the result. And I'm not proud of that or nothing like that, but that was the result. And I'm glad that nobody got hurt no more serious than they did. And I'm glad that really, you know, being on the scene, that more people could have been hurt that night, the way that these guys have really drawn my anger out and drawn me out to protect myself. It's like I would have slayed the world that night, you know what I mean? But I realized how one moment could change your life, you know what I mean? I was facing 8 years in prison,
mm-hmm.
3 years before I even could see the parole board. I had just got a young girl pregnant, you know what I mean? A 16-year-old girl, I think I was 21, and I got a 16-year-old girl pregnant, so that wasn't feeling so good. I mean, it was really like, man, what am I doing right here, yo? You know what I mean? And all the things I learned growing up, you know, as far as knowledge, wisdom, understanding, and respect, and all these things were not being applied. It was more like things that was in my mind and things I could talk good about, but nothing that I could say that I applied. And so I made the decision, you know, thanks to the second chance I got, I stopped myself from going that route. And I've learned to balance my life. For instance, you know, you look at my cousin and you see that, you know, he left from a heart attack. You know, a heart attack just means that you overuse your heart. You know what I mean? Meaning that, you know, he never stopped. If we started at the age of 9 and he's 35 years old when he leaves, that's showing you how many years of doing what we do. But what I used to do, I take a year off. I say, I'm not getting high this year. I'm not drinking this year. I'm not smoking this year. I don't smoke no weed this year. Or I take 6 months off. I also always, like, take chances to balance myself off and not just stay inside something. I'm not doing it to no girls this year. Like I said, from the year of 1993 to 1997, I stayed with one woman, and I was, you know, just a faithful, you know, come home type of guy, workaholic. You know what I mean? I had no, didn't even care about my clothes, nothing, just wanted to work and wanted to build. It's like, so therefore, I got a chance to tilt that scale back a little bit.
Well, I really want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
The RZA is the chief composer and producer of the Wu-Tang Clan. His new book is called The Wu-Tang Manual.